Welcome to the Private Practice Business Academy, where healthcare professionals like yourself earn their business savvy, with your host, Dr. Joe Simon.
Do you know the difference between a proprietor and an entrepreneur? Do you know the difference between marketing and sales? You may think you do, but the truth is being able to work as a medical and health professional and being the best at what you do leaves you little time to learn how to work on your practice and not in your practice. Here at the Private Practice Business Academy, I offer free advice and actionable strategies that you can use today to grow and scale your private practice. Did I say it was for free? Yeah, it is. But if you're looking to partner with someone to take your practice to the next level and take that marketing and business side of your practice to function as a system so it could be replicated to open a second, third, or even multiple locations, then look no further. Reach out to me today. We will schedule a phone call and see if we make a good fit. This is a no-obligation phone call. We just want to make sure that we can work together, and I want to make sure that you can get paid for your knowledge and skill that you have acquired over the years. And why shouldn't you? The purpose of this practice, or your practice, is to basically, A, generate a profit, and in the end, have an exit strategy, so you can leave something for the next generation. Let's schedule that call today. Email me at privatepracticebusinessacademy@gmail.com. Once again, that email address is privatepracticebusinessacademy@gmail.com. I look forward to our chat. Have a great day. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of the Private Practice Business Academy. This is your host, Dr. Joe Simon. On the phone with us today is a respected clinician, Dr. Jan Dummerholt. Dr. Jan Dummerholt has been is a recognized expert in physical therapy treatment for persons with myofascial pain syndrome. He's trained with Jenna Travell and David Simmons for years, and now he teaches courses on dry needling. Lately, Jan, we've had a lot of discussion about dry needling through different LinkedIn threads and Facebook messages, and I myself have taken a course on dry needling to learn more about it. And that's how we connected, and I did not take MyoPain seminars, but we connected through LinkedIn, and I asked you to be on the show, and I'm very excited to have you. So please introduce yourself to the audience and tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to sit down with you and talk about dry needling a little bit. Indeed, I worked with Travell and with David Simons a long time ago. Both people have passed away quite a while back. But that was really my introduction to myofascial pain. I must admit, I trained in the Netherlands, and in my Dutch training, I really never heard of trigger points of myofascial pain. And when I met Jenna Travell in a workshop that she presented, I had no idea who she was. I had never heard of anything. I looked it up later at night that evening and later contacted her to learn more from her. And that was really the start of my interest in myofascial pain. Later, the dry needling was added to that. This was in 1989. So I didn't do any dry needling yet. That came a few years later.
So, Jan, so much to talk about. What got you interested into the MyoPain area in the first place?
Well, as I mentioned, when I saw Jenna Travell at 89 years old doing a workshop at the National Rehabilitation Hospital, and then I worked across the street from that hospital, so I had access to visit it. She had asked for difficult patients, and what she did in a very short period of time with these people, these patients that were the local physicians really threw their hands up in the air, was really quite surprising to me and very impressive. These people moved better, they had better range of motion, they reported very, very little pain. And she didn't do any injections. Travell did mostly trigger point injections and her famous spray and stretch methods. But the difference in these patients was absolutely phenomenal. So that really was the start of my drifting towards myofascial pain more than anything else. And I didn't really plan that, of course, but it happened. I got to meet Travell many times later. I met with one of her associates, Dr. Robert Gerwin, with whom I started working. And Gerwin is a neurologist who worked at Travell for 17, 18 years already at that point. So he introduced me to the whole concept of trigger point injections. In the clinic, we had a pain clinic together. It became frustrating to me that, you know, I could treat patients. I could point out, okay, here are trigger points that don't go away in spite of my manual techniques. I would sometimes mark the skin and send them back to the doctor and said, can you maybe consider injecting these? After a while, I said, you know, there's really no reason why I can't do this myself. So I called the State Board of Physical Therapy in Maryland to say, you know, is there any way I can do this myself? And much to my surprise, they said, yeah, dry needling is in the scope of physical therapy practice in Maryland. You can do this yourself as long as you're trained. I couldn't believe it. So I did get the training. I worked, first of all, of course, with Bob Gerwin, who taught me a lot. He was really my first mentor, and then Janet Travell herself. After a while, I was like, you know, I was told I could do that, but this really tried. I didn't have anything in writing. I couldn't find anything in writing anywhere in the state legislature, in the statutes, in the regulations, or the board. So I called the board again and said, you know, can I really do this dry needling? And they said, of course, we already told you that. That's, it's been approved, no problem. Then a few years, or maybe a year later, I wanted to take a dry needling course in Canada with Dr. Chan Gunn. And Dr. Gunn required that I have a letter from my state board that I could legally do dry needling. So I wrote the board a letter, said, you've already told me twice that I can do this. I now need a letter confirming this so I can take this course program up in Canada. At that point, the letter went to the board, and the board at that point said, you want to do what? We've never heard of dry needling. And that was my introduction to how state boards operate as well, and sometimes don't operate at all well, because the current board had no institutional memory that a previous board had approved dry needling. And they went through the whole process again of looking at it. They came to our clinic. They wanted to see what it is. The board did approve it again, but the previous board had already approved it in 1984. But there was no mechanism at the board venue to look up, okay, what decisions have been made in the past. I do have a letter now from 1984. Where the board approved that. But at that point, that was really my first time that I dealt with a state board that officially the board had made an opinion, had made a ruling. 12 years later, there was no recollection of that whatsoever, other than with the administrator of the board, who remembered that it had been approved. So I got approved again in Maryland, and I took the courses, and I've taken several other courses since then in other countries as well. And slowly but steadily, dry needling became very much a part of my life, both in the clinic and later in teaching programs.
Amazing. Amazing that happens. And the topic of state boards approving and not approving, if we look at across the United States, from what I've seen online, I've only seen 4 states that do not allow dry needling for physical therapists. So that was, and some of it, it's written into the Practice Act where a physical therapist cannot puncture the skin. So, you know, areas like that, it's a little bit tough, I guess, to fight the state board on this. But, you know, I just spoke to a therapist recently who asked me, he goes, well, if I am practicing in one state that allows it and I drive my car over to the other state that doesn't allow it, and he's like, I'm doing the same exact thing. And you know, and obviously I'm not allowed to practice it in the state right next door to mine. So it was a great topic of discussion. Obviously, I think is it more studies, do you think, or more research? Do you think the pushback is coming from other professions that are not allowing physical therapists to do dry needling? What are your thoughts?
It's a little bit of all the above, but there are more states than 4. That what you said is not correct. Right now, Hawaii does not approve dry needling because that's the only state that prohibits penetration of the skin. Mm-hmm. So by definition, you can't do dry needling. California does not approve it. Idaho does not. South Dakota does not. Kansas does not. New York does not. Pennsylvania. Those are the states that do not allow dry needling.
So more than 4.
Some of the states have reversed their opinion. Utah said no several years ago and just recently reversed that. North Carolina said no in 2002 or 2001, I think, as did Tennessee, and they both reversed their opinion 8-9 years later. So those are legal now. But right now, I believe there are one, two, three, four, five, seven states that have said no. About six, seven states that have not don't have a formal opinion about it. Most other states do allow dry needling. There are a few strange states like Florida. Florida does not really have an official opinion on that, at least in my interpretation. But the Florida statute is very strange because the Florida statute states that physical therapists can perform acupuncture as long as they do not penetrate the skin.
That's a
And then the
challenge.
question is, does dry needling fall under that ruling in the statutes or not? You can argue about that, but the Florida statutes don't really give any further knowledge about that. Oregon is another interesting state where the state board did approve dry needling. But then the acupuncture committee ruling working underneath the medical board protested this. There was some discussion in between the two boards, and the Oregon Physical Therapy Board then issued a statement basically saying, we do think it's in the scope of practice, but we strongly recommend you don't do it. And so that kind of left in other words, in the interest of public safety, which I don't really know what that means. So how do state boards approve that? I have been involved with many, many state boards. I've provided state boards information about the process. I've published this in a textbook. I've also testified on behalf of the national APTA and state APTA chapters at different meetings and state boards. And it varies tremendously. I mean, some states basically, I think, they're looking at the sky and say, shall we approve this or not? And it's approved or not right on the spot. Other states go through a lengthy process of actually studying this and taking a look at what is the evidence. Is there any evidence? Is this something we need to do? Other state boards in the past said, what does the APTA think? Tennessee certainly did that in 2001, 2002, when they said, you know, the APTA does not have an opinion on about it, so why should we approve it? It's not taught in schools. That was one reason. In most states, yes, there is a lot of opposition by acupuncture groups. The American Association of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine has a position statement against dry needling by physical therapists. The Council of Colleges of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine also has a similar position statement against dry needling by physical therapists. But overall, they keep pushing back. They keep trying and lots of different methods. In Oregon, the physical therapy community was kind of left alone, but then chiropractors learned about this dry needling. So the chiropractic board approved dry needling by chiropractors, and that was challenged in court by the acupuncture community. And just recently, the judge ruled that dry needling is not in the scope of chiropractic in Oregon. So that was one of actually the only legal action that acupuncture has ever taken that they won. Again, not directed to chiropractors, but to physical therapists. But in many states, acupuncture groups, I think, feel very threatened. They always use a public safety argument that how can physical therapists learn this in a few weekends? Well, we have 2,000 or 2,500 hours of acupuncture training. It must be a public health hazard. And that's a sentiment that resonates with senators and congressmen, of course, in general. And it has no real basis other than emotional packaging. But that is an argument that's used pretty much in every state where this is brought up. It has no validity, but it resonates well and people pay attention to it.
I mean, so for the people that are listening to the show right now and have not taken a course like myself, or haven't basically do not have your knowledge about it, but what would be the dangers of someone that's only taken a weekend course in dry needling compared to someone that's obviously trained for over 2,000 hours in acupuncture and obviously Chinese medicine, which is even more, I assume. What dangers do they bring up, or what safety concerns do they bring up that the general public should be aware of?
Well, the acupuncture groups bring up several potential dangers, but you know, none of those are based on reality. The biggest risk of dry needling is causing a pneumothorax. But any needling over the chest wall, if you needle trigger points in the serratus anterior, for example, you're very, very close to the pleura. any of the chest wall muscles, you can potentially cause a pneumothorax. The chance is small, but it is possible. We actually published a study. We looked at the adverse event rate of dry needling by physiotherapists. This is a study we did in Ireland, where I teach courses as well. And we had almost 8,000 physical therapies, treatments included in the study. So a pretty large database, 7,629, I believe, to be exact. And we calculated the risk of a significant adverse event like a pneumothorax to be less than 0.04%. If you compared that to a significant event with aspirin or ibuprofen, that's in the 14 to 18% range. So 14, 15, 18% versus 0.04% as the risk of dry needling by physical therapist. So acupunctures may bring up the pneumothorax, but realistically, we don't really know how many pneumothoraces do occur, both in acupuncture and with dry needling, because these are typically not reported. So there is no reporting mechanism to know exactly how many have occurred. Acupuncture sometimes bring up acupuncture concerns that physical therapists may not be familiar with so-called forbidden points during pregnancy. And these forbidden points are spread out over the body. There's some in the legs, some in the low back, some in other parts. And the notion is that if a physical therapist would needle one of those forbidden points, that it could lead to spontaneous abortion. And that argument was brought up when I testified in Mississippi, when I testified in Virginia. It's a common argument that's brought up by acupuncturists, but again, it has zero validity. And it's a little bit interesting, but even in the acupuncture literature, there's ample evidence that this is a discarded notion. It is a bit of a traditional point of view in traditional acupuncture, but there is no validity to it whatsoever.
And I want to also bring up that the interview is not live, but I did interview an acupuncturist and asked him about dry needling, and it was two of them, a husband and wife, and they both said their argument, they had nothing against dry needling, they just said you couldn't get the same results as acupuncture could deliver, and that was their entire argument. They did not bring up the safety argument, which, you know, I didn't, in the questioning, I did not actually bring that up myself, but their entire argument, which, you know, I kind of agreed with. I said, obviously, it is not acupuncture, and what you're doing obviously is a different form of treatment compared to dry needling. And they basically agreed with that. So it wasn't, and I understand what everyone is saying, and I brought the same question up to them about do you feel threatened that physical therapists are now doing an acupuncture type form of treatment? And, you know, to their defense, they came up and they responded, well, it's the same thing a physical therapist could say to a personal trainer. And it was a very excellent answer to bring that up, to say that, you know, a personal trainer is doing therapeutic exercises these days, and a physical therapist is, you know, losing out comparatively to that. So it was a really good discussion, and I see how I kind of see the acupuncturist side of the story. I understand a little more about the dry needling side of the story, so it makes a lot of sense. Jan, you've...
Unfortunately, that argument is not what acupuncture groups bring up in boardrooms.
Of course not.
And it's always a public health issue, and it's always the same kind of silly arguments that... Because even saying that you learn it in a few weekend courses, I studied 22,000 hours of studying acupuncture, that entirely negates the professional education of physical therapists. I mean, the average doctoral degree is 2,676 hours for physical therapy. So if you want to compare a discipline to a discipline, you need to look at the education of physical therapists, including the courses in dry needling, versus the education of acupuncturists. And then you'll see that physical therapists actually usually have a longer education with much more emphasis on anatomy and neurophysiology. To me, dry needling needs to be anatomy-driven. We do have several acupuncturists who take our courses, and most of them are totally lost in the anatomy part of it. So most acupuncturists don't needle very deeply. It stays fairly superficial. But again, it's even a bit artificial to talk about acupuncture as a group, because there are so many different schools of acupuncture that when you say acupuncture, it's kind of like saying, okay, I have a car, and I want you to know what kind of car I drive. There is no way that you can guess that.
Absolutely.
And so when you say I'm an acupuncturist, okay, I probably can understand. Just like my car probably has four wheels, and when you say an acupuncturist, most likely you use needles. But what your idea of acupuncture is, I don't know. Did you study French Vietnamese acupuncture? Did you study Chinese acupuncture? Did you study American style acupuncture? Or even in China, there are over 80 different schools of acupuncture. So to use the term acupuncture as if it's an homogeneous group is kind of erroneous. If you do Western medical acupuncture, well, that looks an awful lot like dry needling. If you do traditional Chinese medicine acupuncture, there's very little in common other than a needle. So it's a little bit hard to just say, well, acupuncture is a dry needling or not. Dry needling is in the scope of acupuncture practice, but it's also in the scope of veterinary practice, in the scope of dental practice, of medicine. There's a One of our graduates is a nurse in Massachusetts. She does dry needling in her private practice. So dry needling is just a tool. It's not an discipline. It's not the end all. When I argue with or discuss it with acupuncturists, they tell me, like, how can you say that dry needling is acupuncture? Like as if that's all you do in acupuncture. And so the discussions often become very emotional. And back to these forbidden points, one of the opponents to physical therapists and dry needling is an acupuncturist in Colorado. She actually wrote the position statement against dry needling for the Council of Colleges of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine. But she's also a midwife. She has published herself that there is no validity to forbidden points. Yet this is brought up every single time I testify in a state boardroom. The argument is brought up, what have you learned about forbidden points? The scientific literature clearly says there is no such thing. You could even take it a step further. If it were that easy to cause a spontaneous abortion, why in the world are abortion clinics not using these points? They don't, because it doesn't work. It is a fictitious belief that doesn't count anymore. So I'm glad to hear that you interviewed acupuncturists who did not feel threatened by us. In general, if you look online, if you see what acupuncturists publish about dry needling, it is very much a threat. I mean, there's an Acupuncture Today, a magazine from acupuncturists, actually has an article that says actually a threat to our profession is this dry needling. And one of the problems with acupuncture, of non-medical acupuncturists, we're talking mostly about people who went to acupuncture school, learned acupuncture, not as physicians or dentists or veterinarians, is that the vast majority of acupuncturists currently work in the United States do not make a living. I mean, the former president of the Oregon Acupuncture Society has published that on his website, and he looked at it like, well, at best, in his estimate, maybe 30% of licensed acupuncturists make enough to make a living. So you add on to that, and okay, now all of a sudden patients have options to go to an acupuncturist or a physical therapist. Physical therapists typically do have third-party reimbursement, although dry needling is not always covered. Acupuncturists typically do not have third-party reimbursement. So I think to a lot of people, it is a very threatening kind of situation. And not to everyone. We have acupuncturists take our courses who really don't share those sentiments. And you say, I need to learn this because I'm an acupuncturist. I can later say in my marketing, I can say, look, I did my 2,000 hours of acupuncture training and I did dry needling. That PT only did PT and a little bit dry needling. Maybe you should come to me. I have more experience in needling techniques. Perfectly fine. Let the consumer decide where to go to, and that will be, it will regulate itself.
Yeah, and you brought up so many excellent points, and I just want to say that's from the fact about the abortion clinics to the fact that dry needling should be more anatomically driven, which even the hours for the physical therapist that we put in for a doctorate degree. Obviously, you've done your homework and you've presented this to many state boards, so that's why you have so much information, and it's great. And the one statement you said that I really hung on to was, dry needling is a tool and not a discipline. And I think that could define a lot of what we say to referring physicians, to the general public, to everyone that is interested in dry needling. And this way it could, keep the acupuncturist to understand that, hey, look, we are not
doing acupuncture. This is dry needling. It's completely separate. But I completely understand where they're coming from, and they feel threatened for their monetary gain, or even if they're not getting reimbursed by the insurance companies. And that's the main issue at the end of the day, is that a patient would like to have their health insurance cover almost everything. So if it covers physical therapy, great. If it doesn't cover acupuncture, then you know the chances of them seeing that acupuncturist drop drastically. Unless it was recommended, unless they had great results prior. So you made a lot of great points. I think you've solved a lot of arguments that I've seen back and forth on many different threads, from physical therapists to acupuncturists and chiropractors as well, who also employ acupuncturists and physical therapists. I see that you've published three books. So have these books all been about pain, or about pain syndromes, or were they more dealing more with the dry needling?
The last book is called Trigger Point Dry Needling, which is specifically about dry needling, obviously. The previous book is more about the current state of scientific evidence of trigger points in general, myofascial pain. So that's more of a theoretical book. The Trigger Point Dry Needling book is much more a practical book that has a whole manual kind of how to do dry needling, almost like a little cookbook, although you can't really use cookbooks in this. I have published another book in German, which is a combination of those two almost, that has some theoretical backgrounds in Trigger Point, the science of it, what the current findings. But it also has dry needling and manual trigger point techniques for 30 muscles, I believe, if I remember correctly. And then, of course, I've contributed to many, many chapters, many books in medical books and physical therapy books.
Jan, that's I'm just looking at Jan. Jan's your basic resume that I'm staring at on his LinkedIn profile. I see that he has done so much, three books, 54 chapters, 80 articles. There's a lot of expertise and knowledge that you bring to the table. And it's great to see this, because then it just brings so much validity to the argument of dry needling, acupuncturists, everything. We see so much information is provided here. And I urge everyone, if they do get a minute, please go and check out the LinkedIn page for Jan Dommerholt, and you can see all his information. You teach MyoPain seminars, MyoPainSeminars.com, if I have that. Is that the correct link?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, so MyoPainSeminars.com. Tell me about the courses. What would I expect if I signed up for a course today?
Well, we have many different courses. We started with trigger point courses back in 1997. We did our first dry needling course. That was the first course in the country. At that point, the only... as far as I know, the only company where you could do anything with dry needling was in Canada. There was Chan Gunn's program, but nothing existed in the U.S. We've been teaching courses, but never included dry needling. When I met Bob Irwin and Travell, they were teaching courses already in the U.S., but they were usually more manual therapy courses with spray and stretch techniques and things of that nature. In 1996, we started teaching dry needling courses in Europe, particularly in Spain. We introduced it to that country. We've introduced dry needling later to Chile, to Ireland, to the Netherlands. Though in the Netherlands was one other therapist who had done a few courses there, but we were very close behind that, and multiple other countries. So the dry needling program is currently by far our largest course program. Last year, we taught over 75 courses in the U.S. alone, which is quite a lot, of course. And we also teach courses in many, many foreign countries. We teach courses in the Netherlands, Ireland. I've taught courses in Germany, Switzerland, Spain, Italy, Israel, Dubai, Bahrain.
All over the world, yeah.
We, of course, are scheduled in Qatar, in India next year, Thailand. I mean, it's really South America, Peru this summer, Chile. We, of course, are in many different parts of the world.
So
the dry needling courses are the main thing. We also have manual trigger point courses. We also have a canine trigger point course, which we teach to veterinarians and veterinary assistants and technicians. Then we have a few almost like spin-off courses. We teach a temporomandibular or craniomandibular course program that we're introducing from Europe called Crafter. We also teach a clinical anatomy course for people who do dry needling, and that is done with world-renowned Professor André Fleming, and the guy who came up with the force closure and form closure ideas, the sacroiliac joints. He teaches a phenomenal anatomy course, functional anatomy course up in Maine, where we actually have lots of anatomical specimens, and the participants are actually invited to verify their needling techniques. So if I teach you in a course how to needle the psoas major muscle, you can actually verify what we told you made any actually sense. Or if we want to look at how do we needle the lateral pterygoid muscle you can't palpate in the anatomy lab, you can actually see where that needle actually goes, what the risk would be, what you could do. So it's a phenomenal learning experience. And that course is only available for people who have graduated from our dry needling program already. That's a little bit higher level. So we have a lot of different programs that we do. We teach fascia manipulation courses imported from Italy, from the Stecco family. And so there's a lot of different options.
So is it are the courses for dry needling, is it a certification process? Is it one course? Is it two courses? How many courses?
We've modified our courses quite a lot over the years. When we first started, we had several manual trigger point courses followed by one dry needling course. Well, we didn't really have a frame of reference over the years. That's now 17 years ago we started that. Over the years, we've modified that several times to become better and better at teaching it. Our courses now consist of two foundation courses, level one and two. After those two courses, people can really treat, I'd say, 85% of all the muscles in the body. Then we have two more advanced courses, also course three and four, where we go a lot deeper into the material. Also, a lot more theoretical knowledge will be shared in those courses. But we include the pelvic floor, for example. We include all the craniomandibular muscles, including the pterygoids, the lateral medial pterygoid, and some more challenging muscles of scalene muscles that many course programs do not cover. At the end of every course is a quiz. We do an assessment in every course of the practical skills of students. So it's not just a check of, hey, yes, you can copy me, but people actually have to show and do a theoretical test. At the end of the four courses, there's actually a pretty tricky practical and theoretical exam. The theoretical exam is 80 multiple choice questions. And yes, not everyone passes. It's quite difficult. You have to do a lot of reading. We actually demand that people know the myofascial pain literature and the literature in general. The sensitization literature is all included in that package. People get the textbook, trigger point needling textbook, they get a folder with over 400 pages of scientific articles that we expect people to actually know and have read. So it's a pretty difficult exam. And then we have two practical exams of one muscle on the chest wall and one muscle somewhere else. With, again, pretty rigorous guidelines as far as what you need to pass. So I think it's fair to say that our program is by far the most rigorous as far as academic demands and skill demands. There are currently 16 different course programs in the United States that I have counted. Many of them are from former students, which is interesting to me. When I look at YouTube and I see demonstrations of physical therapists practicing or showing off dry needling, my stomach usually turns because the quality is so poor. There's one video I watched the other day where, you know, we required that you wear gloves in the course. I know that many other course programs don't require that, although it is an OSHA requirement. And the video I just watched the other day was a physical therapist had a glove on the hand he holds the needle, but not in the other hand he needles towards. Well, that is not very smart, in my opinion, because you have to assume that every patient has hepatitis B, and I would like to be protected a little bit better. There's a lot of stuff online, a lot of stuff that's taught that, you know, I can't really agree with. I think it's a lot of people jumping on the bandwagon right now. You can question qualifications of many of the needling programs. Taking a course is probably not sufficient to teach a course. I mean, I can tell you that our instructors go to a three-year training program before they can teach a course by themselves, and that's after they're certified in our program. I am a little bit concerned about that part. I think that the standards should be much higher. Not everyone agrees with me, of course. Some people say, well, you just need to learn the trick because the physical therapists have enough education to apply dry needling and use their best judgments. I disagree with that. I think if we want to be an evidence-informed profession, we should know the evidence. We should be tested on the evidence. We should know the scientific data. We should not get stuck in online discussions that there is no valid concept of trigger points. There are several websites where that occurs. I mean, Evidence in Motion right now has that discussion going on. SomaSimple.com has that discussion had many, many times. In my opinion, we educate therapists and actually review the scientific literature. We shouldn't have these discussions anymore because they're really kind of outdated.
Absolutely.
People say there's no valid concept to trigger points. Well, if you know the literature at NIH, they visualize trigger points. You can look at trigger points. You can measure trigger points. There's a lot of research in that. You can deny all that and say, oh, it's all flawed research. Sure, you can do that. That's fine. But, you know, people are entitled to opinions, of course. I think that rigorous testing is the key to creating qualified physical therapists. I also understand that not all physical therapists want to go through that kind of process because it's a lot of work. Yes. You actually have to study. Many of the therapists said it's the hardest exam they've ever taken. But once they pass, everyone's very, very happy because now they can stand up in their community. They can discuss it with physicians. They can do in-services that are knowledgeable and evidence-driven. They can talk to insurance companies, get reimbursed for it if they need it, et cetera, et cetera. Rather than, well, I don't really know the answer to that because I just know a trick. You know, so there's some controversy there. I'm definitely opinionated about what I think should be happening, but, you know, I understand that not everyone agrees with me, and that's okay.
Well, you're true. Well, what you've said is a lot of information that you basically just said, but it makes a lot of sense. If someone wants to be, if someone wants to treat or teach this, if you're teaching anything, you should have a lot of experience. It's not just a student that just takes a course and then all of a sudden picks up and says, hey, I can teach this topic. Obviously, years of education or studying that goes behind it. I agree with you on that. That's it's a very valid point that you make. If you want to teach something, you have to be able to say that you know it very well. One point that I want to ask you, and this is a mm-hmm. business podcast, so the one thing that I see from many, and I'm not going to just pick on physical therapists, but dentists and chiropractors and medical professionals, they learn a new trick. I'm going to call it a new trick. They learn a new procedure. They learn a new trick. They learn something that's new, but they have problems explaining it or even marketing this to the general public or to other professionals to say, hey, this is what this is. Is there something that you're offering right now, or is there something that's where you have found that, hey, this works very good? Any technique that you have found that works really good? An example I'm going to give you is some people have taken a dry needling course, and they have just basically gone to the current patient list, right? And the patients that are treating now, and they say, hey, I've learned this new technique. And they're going basically by word of mouth. And I've looked thoroughly to see if anyone's really advertising this. And I even looked at acupuncturist advertising. It's not really there. Now, is there a reason? Do you think it's because people are afraid of needles? Is this why we don't see so much from even acupuncturists promoting their practice?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that it has more to do with the lack of business acumen of acupuncturists and physical therapists. I think that a lot of physical therapists properly. In general, I mean, I do work. We do a lot of corporate contracts. We teach courses to corporations, and these corporations often work with us. And some of them are very smart, and some of them are not so smart. I mean, one corporation has on their website. A special site devoted to dry needling. This is our therapist is certified by MyoPain Seminars, which is a link to our website, and they really promote this very, very nicely. Others don't do that. Many times, the advertising is word of mouth. I mean, there's a clinic in Kalispell, Montana, where we did our courses, and all the therapists there are certified. 6 months, 7 months after we left, after the exams, the business manager contacted me and said, this has been the best business investment I've ever made. It's not cheap. I mean, it costs money. Dry needling courses are more expensive than others because you need to have a greater student-instructor ratio because of safety concerns. But she said that they have seen a 40% increase in business Because what happened, patients came back to their doctors. The doctors would call the therapist and say, what the world have you done? You've been working with Mrs. Johnson for years, and all of a sudden her back pain is gone. What did you do? The next step often is that the physician says, you know what? I have some back problems. Do you think that works for me? They've seen a 40%+ increase in their business, and that is really not uncommon. How well people market it, that depends all on how good people are marketing in general. You know, we just started a corporate contract with a new company in Virginia this morning. Literally this morning, I got an email from their marketing director. Can we sit down sometime and talk about how we best can market this? That company will be very successful doing it. Most companies don't do that.
Yeah.
Companies I know, we did a private course in the Wisconsin area. That company has written pieces for the local newspapers. They have clinics all over Wisconsin. They got in the media, and then it will happen by itself. Patients, however, no matter what, patients are the best referral sources.
Absolutely.
No doubt about it.
Absolutely. Word of mouth is always the best starting point for marketing, and that's especially when it's a new technique. And if you're just learning it, I would obviously recommend starting with your own patients that already know it, like, and trust you. You don't want to go and try something brand new on someone that doesn't really know you just yet. So if you're brand new at this, I agree. Now, the reason I brought that up is because I've two of my clients right now are doing dry needling, and another reason why I took a dry needling course is because for me to help market their practice better, I needed to know more information about it. I myself did not understand it. I said I can't write a marketing piece, or I can't, you know, write an article if I have zero understanding of it. And it has helped me tremendously, and exactly what you said, it's just experiencing it myself and attempting it on a patient to see how it works. For me, I have to I agree with you on one thing, and we don't have the 40% increase in business just yet, but I definitely see it because the patients are already talking about it. So
yeah, there's one other part to that. I think that if you look at marketing and in general, I mean, I have a master's in healthcare administration as well, and I apply that sometimes. If you want to get in the media, there's ways to do it and ways not to do it, and I think a lot of therapists don't really understand that. If you contact a newscaster, they're not interested in attachments to your email. They're not going to even open your email because there are policies against it. But if you link yourself to a story in the news and then contact the newscaster, let's say for whatever TV station, and it's like, you know, unfortunately, this kind of dramatic experience happens all the time in our clinic. We do this new controversial technique of dry needling, which has helped so many of our patients, whatever. If you pique the interest of someone in the news, whether it's in the print media or in the TV media or even on the online media, that makes a huge difference. If you can attach yourself to some celebrity who had an injury or an athlete who had an injury, if people have groin pulls, you know, that usually means that they have trigger points in the pectineus muscle. And these are muscles you can easily treat with dry needling. Now, it shouldn't be a big deal. I mean, if you look at professional athletes who do that, we have trained all the therapists of the Association of Tennis Professionals, the ATP, and the Women's Tennis Association, WTA. The top world tennis players get dry needling every single day. Now, so if you can attach yourself like, hey, athletes, but I do this technique as well. Nadal gets dry needling. In my clinic, I do the exact same thing. Now, you can't use the ATP name in that, but you can certainly say, you know what? We do the exact same thing in my clinic. You have to be a little savvy with how you want to market yourself without being unethical, of course. I think that a lot of people don't do this properly. I don't believe that good marketing is saying, like, well, this is not acupuncture. That just makes acupuncturists angry because from their perspective, it is acupuncture. So when you market your services, I don't think you need to put other people down. You need to elevate yourself. Like, hey, you need to stand on your own rights, and I am qualified to do this. That, I think, is much more effective. Last year, the Washington Post had an article about myofascial pain and dry needling. I was quoted in that article. That same article appeared in Golf News in Dubai. The exact same article, my clients in Dubai read this exact same paper. Now, that is worldwide marketing. And now, even if you're not in the article, you can certainly use that article as written in the Washington Post, according to the Washington Post, blah, 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 blah. I have never seen a physical therapist use that piece, but it's there. Excellent. You know, so I think we could be a lot more creative and need to think a little bit more outside the box in how we market our services. Marketing to the public is by far more effective than marketing to physicians.
And Jan, that's that is a great piece of advice to end off this interview with. Marketing to the general public is much more effective than to physicians, even though we have many physicians on this that listen to this podcast. But as referrals go, and this is for everyone across the board, it is a challenge. And that's why we give out so much great information on the show about marketing and business strategies. It also keeps me in business. I'm very happy that sometimes people get results from the marketing. But the dry needling, I have to say, you're absolutely right. Never knock someone else down. Just elevate yourself. Promote yourself the best way you can. Try not to, that type of marketing when you position yourself against someone else that's a competitor is never really works that well. So it's best to always just elevate yourself. And great point that you brought up, Jan. MyoPain Seminars is your site where all your courses are listed, correct?
That's correct. Yes.
Excellent. I urge everyone, please check out MyoPainSeminars.com. Sign up for a course. See what everything's about. If you have it, go all the way through and get certified. I think Jan has so much information. I think everyone that's trained under him has spoken very highly of him about his knowledge of the subject. So please check out the website. Leave a comment. Let me know your thoughts. If you've been trained by Jan before, if you've never taken a dry needling course, check out the site. Ask any questions you would like. We'll make sure we can get you in contact with Jan. Jan, is there an easy way for people listening to the show to get in touch with you?
Easiest is email info@myopainseminars.com. We'll do it.
Excellent stuff. So again, info@myopainseminars.com. As always, we will keep this resource on our resources page of privatepracticebusinessacademy.com. Jan, I appreciate your time today. I've learned so much in a matter of less than an hour, I got to say. Usually our interviews run for about 30 minutes, but today it was just so much good information. This is great stuff. Absolutely great job today. I love it. Anything else that we need to know, Jan, before we get off the phone?
No, I'd like to thank you for the invitation to share some ideas with you.
Thank you so much. And Jan, always a pleasure. Once again, everyone, thank you for listening. This is Dr. Joe Simon from the Private Practice Business Academy.